Next up, we have Dan Griffin, who is president and founder of JW Secure. Let me get your slides, Dan. Number 19. Does that look right?
That's me.
Okay. Dan is also, besides the founder of JW Secure, he's also a Microsoft Enterprise Security MVP. He's the author of two books, Cloud Security and Control, and The Four Pillars of Endpoint Security, and a frequent conference speaker. Dan holds a master's degree in computer science and engineering from the University of Washington and a bachelor's degree in computer sciences from Indiana University. Please welcome Dan Griffin to the Cloud Developer Summit and Expo.
Thank you very much. I did write two books because that's table stakes for a consultant. People take you much more seriously if you show up with a book. It makes you an expert, right? And whatever the title of the book is, you're automatically an expert. Anyway, in all seriousness, I brought some copies of it. I'd be happy for you guys to take them. I actually think the content is a little bit more interesting than I'm probably making it sound. It was contributed by by my team and from a lot of the projects we've worked on since I founded my consulting company, which is called JW Secure, 8 years ago. I'll bring them up so maybe if anybody's interested after the panel session. And I have actually more in my hotel room, so please really don't be shy. So lately, what my team has been working on is taking some of the trusted computing models that have been published by government entities such as the National Institute of Standards and Technology here in the U.S., the Trusted Computing Group, which is an open standards organization, taking some of those client security computing models and applying them to what we think are the interesting scenarios in the cloud. Many of which were just laid out, talking about consumer scenarios. We like to focus more on the knowledge worker space, focusing on the enterprise, talking about people who are not only consuming but creating content. How can we protect your cloud assets, essentially protect the enterprise, because it's all about the data, from a compromised host? How do we ensure that if that host doesn't meet the security bar, if that host is not compliant with corporate security, with enterprise security, with national intelligence security, that you can't get the data in the first place, and after you've gotten the data, if the security profile of that host changes, then we want to make sure you lose access to that data, even data that you already have on the host. So the bottom line is, yes, the government invests in many of these technologies, but we think that also there's a lag in private sector investment, particularly in defensive security technologies. All the script kiddies, all the hackers, all the guys who were bored in college and gals, they're spending their time on attack because it gets them more attention. It probably gets them more money. We'd like to change that because we think that there are a lot of latent opportunities for entrepreneurs in defensive security, and there's a major pent-up demand for it in the enterprise for defensive security technologies that actually work and that actually are manageable and that work in the cloud and that work with a heterogeneous mobile device environment, BYOD, that kind of thing. So the history of mobile devices is somewhat checkered, I'm sure you'll agree. Early devices weren't really all that mobile. Needless to say, they were not at all secure. Does everybody remember the Palm Trio, the Compaq IPAC? I got to win a Compaq IPAC when I was in a sales role on campus, and man, it was like the best day of my life as a student getting this brick, and in hindsight, it was like, I mean, it was useless, right? It hardly did anything. Whereas now, obviously, we have highly sophisticated devices with 100,000 apps to choose from that are very functional, and yet, still just as difficult to secure. So again, we think there are some gaps here, and we're trying to work on solving those gaps. Everybody who sits at a Starbucks is on an open, connected wireless network with their laptop. Essentially, in this country, everybody is connected with their smartphone on an open, connected wireless network. Again, there's a big security risk there. Lisbeth Salander, the girl with the dragon tattoo, if anybody's read the book or seen the movie, She's like the prototype here in the media of the uber-capable hacker. And believe me when I say that people like that actually do exist. There are lots of them. They're in every country, including this one. And they're highly capable of hacking any environment. But, as we've learned in the press from, you know, the Target, Home Depot, P.F. Chang's, unfortunately, sometimes it's as simple as not checking the box, not looking at the audit activity that you're getting from your environment, that really could have solved those attacks, at least immediately when they started, if not prevented them from starting in the first place. So there's obviously both good news and bad news there. Good news is that the technology is available. In many cases, bad news is that they're being underutilized. So how do we define some key characteristics of a trustworthy machine? Because as we learned from Terminator 1 and 2, sometimes a machine is acting trustworthy, and sometimes it's not. Well, we believe that you can define some key characteristics of a trustworthy machine. And again, there are some technologies that are available in the market now that lets you use those characteristics once defined to express policy, for example, in a typical cloud environment where, let's say you're trying to access SharePoint, it's hosted in the cloud, you're trying to download a document to your phone, you know, merger plans, something sensitive like that, edit it, publish it back. The point is there are some technologies that that SharePoint server can use that are actually existing on the client device to ensure that that client device meets the security profile for accessing that data. So for example, we have the Trusted Platform Module. This is a security chip that's traditionally been implemented as a discrete tamper-resistant chip on your motherboard. It's now more likely to be in a system on a chip architecture, just part of your trusted execution environment code. Measured boot is a technology that's based on the TPM chip. Basically what measured boot lets you do is as the device boots up, you know, you press the power button and you got your BIOS and your kernel, your operating system kernel, your boot drivers. Measured boot basically takes a record of those components as they build up the stack, and that record is saved for future reference. Remote attestation, finally, lets that client device take that record of what's booted, of that boot environment, that computing environment that exists on that client device at any given time, and actually make some cryptographic references of the state of that client environment and ship those cryptographic references off to a remote server for the remote server to decide, well, do I like the software that's running? Is the software I recognize to be secure? Does this log show tampering? This kind of thing. So we can get a little bit technical here, or we can avoid that. But in any case, as I mentioned, the way measured boot works is essentially as each component in your boot procedure loads, it computes the hash of the next component. When I say hash, I mean a cryptographic number, cryptographic representation of that component on disk, and writes it into this tamper-resistant location of your chip or of your CPU on a cell phone. And at the end of that process, it all goes into this boot log, all that data, including some boot metadata about the device, was the disk encrypted, rebooting in admin mode, this kind of thing. And an application can later make reference to that boot log. Remote attestation takes that boot log and ships it off to a remote server. And the idea is that, again, the remote server can make some really simple decisions about that boot log. Essentially, do I recognize that, for example, the people who provided the binaries to that client system are all known manufacturers to me? Is it like a short list kind of thing of, you know, Dell, HP, Microsoft, Symantec? And if every binary that shows up in that list comes from one of those trusted manufacturers, then, you know, it's probably okay. If the device booted with an encrypted disk, yeah, that's okay. That meets our security profile. And the point is that this remote server actually now has a way to gather that information from the device with high integrity, with high cryptographic integrity, in fact, which to date has actually been essentially impossible. There's no way for their server to remotely query your device and actually be on the honor system and say, hey, device, are you secure? Oh, yeah, I'm secure. Give me the docs. You know, that doesn't work, right? So this gives us a way to do that actually with a fairly strong cryptographic background. As with any security technology, there are some weaknesses. You always got to read the fine print when you're adopting a new technology, of course, in particular, security technology. For example, you know, there's a question about the supply chain. Let's be frank, many of the chips that we use in our devices today are made in China, made in Taiwan, are made overseas, right? And if you are, for example, involved in a potential deal where it's worth maybe so many billions of dollars and you've got a domestic company competing against an overseas company, and that overseas company provides your security hardware or your security software, you could see some potential conflicts there when the numbers start to get big. So we need to be aware of those potential conflicts when you're operating on, you know, the large enterprise, and of course, needless to say, in the government information security space as well. Integrity of the hardware, again, basically there's some caveats here. One is that this is not a technology that is going to be bulletproof against a trusted insider. So this is not a technology that's going to prevent your trusted insider from breaking out his or her electron microscope, capping your chip, reading out key data that he or she shouldn't otherwise have access to. This is a technology for protecting your insiders against external hackers. Against hackers, for example, using so-called advanced persistent threats, rootkits, this kind of thing that today are actually very difficult to defend against. The idea is that we have a technology here that actually makes it much easier for those unwitting power users or, you know, unwitting business decision makers with access to sensitive data to be able to protect themselves from electronic threats that are otherwise very difficult to detect. My company has developed a solution in this space. Probably goes without any surprise. The idea is that we want to ensure, using the mechanisms that I've just described, that your data stays encrypted. And the idea is that, you know, frankly, we think that the bar is really low right now for improvement on this scenario. You know, people are running around with sensitive documents on their iPhone, right? And it's not encrypted, right? So it's easy to do better than that. Several people have talked about leapfrog opportunities. We think there's a leapfrog opportunity here. The idea is that we're ensuring that the data is encrypted. We're ensuring that the device meets a very secure profile. We're ensuring that the device profile changes even after that data has been downloaded. The user can't access the data until the device gets back into compliance. My company announced our solution called StrongNet at RSA this year. We've got a couple pilot deployments going with some Fortune 500 companies located in the Seattle area. Obviously looking to expand on that scenario. The key detail here is, as I mentioned, these are open standards. There are lots of different solutions based on these standards. The technology is out there. It just needs to be adopted and deployed. So there's an opportunity here to do basically what we learned from Terminator 1 and 2, and that's learn to trust machines, if only for a short period of time. Thanks, guys.